The ACC is working on a new revenue distribution model to help hold things together in the conference. Will it work? And former Virginia Tech point guard Devin Wilson has a new role at his alma mater. He'll join the show to talk about that this week on Teal and Barber. Welcome to episode 111 of Teal and Barber, the Richmond Times-Dispatch and Richmond.com's Virginia Tech, UVA, and ACC sports podcast. You can subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your pods. I'm Mike Barber, ACC beat writer for the paper, and joining me as always, my co-host, the 14-time sports writer of the year and the Virginia Sports Hall of Famer, Mr. David Teal. David, how are you?
Mike, is it officially summer since we're past Memorial Day, or do we have to have the solstice, or how do we play this?
I think it all depends on your calendar. For me, summer probably began, with Memorial Day weekend, with my trip up to Philadelphia for the lacrosse Final Four, where Virginia came up a little short, fell in the semifinals. But once you cross that Memorial Day weekend bridge, to me, that it's summertime. You can get out the shorts and the flip-flops.
There you go.
Now, David, you had a slightly more exotic destination that you visited than Philadelphia. You were down in Amelia Island for the league meetings. And one of the big things that was talked about and apparently quite hotly debated at times was the idea of a new revenue sharing model, an uneven revenue distribution. Now we get the announcement that that's coming. The ADs, the presidents, everybody's on board. We're going to have an uneven revenue distribution model in the ACC. Why don't we start by, can you just explain in a nutshell what that means?
Well, Mike, for decades, the ACC, like most of its Power Five peers, has distributed revenue essentially in equal shares to all of its full-time members. Notre Dame does not receive a full share because it doesn't compete in football. For example, believe it or not, Arkansas's share of SEC revenue was like $500,000 more than Alabama's in the SEC's most recent tax return. So that's how equal it gets. And Vanderbilt's was just a tick below Alabama's. And in the ACC, it's very similar. No matter how you fare in competition, you are getting your equal share of revenue. And as the ACC has fallen further behind the Big Ten and the SEC in revenue and average distribution to its member schools, some of the ACC's more aggressive football brands, looking at you, Florida State and Clemson, have really pushed this idea of unequal revenue shares, of essentially what they are calling a success initiative, or as some people have called it, eat what you kill.
I like that in a nutshell. Yeah, it's got a nice ring to it. Now, David, the thing that's interesting, though, to me about that, because, and you'd written about this previously, that there is a big gap here, right? The ACC's revenue is simultaneously, it's at an all-time high.
Yeah.
And at the same time, it is lagging way behind the SEC and the Big Ten. I think the last time you wrote it was 39 million about a share for ACC teams, while Big Ten schools were at 58 million, and SEC, I think, was just under 50 million. And those numbers are about to go up, right, with their new TV deals. So you think about that money and how you're trying to bridge the gap. But the subtext here is Clemson and Florida State are the schools that the ACC seems most worried about jumping ship, right, being part of conference realignment. So this is, in a sense, a way to placate them so that they're not looking over the fence to see if the grass is greener.
Well, Mike, I think people have already looked over the fence. We are long past that. When Oklahoma and Texas left the Big 12 for the SEC and USC and UCLA bolted the Pac-12 for the Big 10, everybody started looking. As Whit Babcock likes to say, you've got your head on a swivel. Everybody's looking out for their own best interests, as well they should, by the way. But there are two things to keep in mind here. No one, I repeat, no one has an invitation from another conference, and I don't believe one is pending for any ACC member. Number two, there is the matter of how expensive, how cost prohibitive it would be right now to leave the ACC, because not only would you have a $120 million exit fee, you also have the matter of the grant of rights, which essentially gives all of your media money, your television monies, to the conference through 2036. So basically, if you wanted to leave today, you're looking at $500 million tab. Oof. And that's not going to fly for anybody.
That's like a dinner in South Beach with me. That's pricey.
And that's before drinks, too.
That's the food only. That's just what's going on in the expense report. But when you look at all of that and those numbers that you just talked about and the grant of rights, that was another big topic down there in Amelia Island. And the thing that I wondered about, because what we kind of heard was that different schools had their lawyers and their legal teams diving into that, as well you should, right? Whether you're a school that might leave or a school that has no chance to leave or a school that's somewhere in the middle, You want to know, am I bound and how bound are my partners here?
Sure.
The thing I didn't understand about that, just knowing what lawyers charge, why didn't the league get together and just say, hey, we're all in this together. Let's have some transparency. Let's have one tab here. And let's have a legal team come together, examine this thing, and report back to everyone. So everybody's working with the same info. I mean, that just seemed to me like an opportunity to kind of bring people together on the same page, even though at the end, the information may be used in different ways.
Not enough trust there, Mike.
Yeah.
Seriously, I think everyone wants their own in-house counsel looking at this. And let's also stress to folks that everyone in this conference willingly signed that grant of rights, ran to it, in fact, because that was the trade-off for getting the network, and which everyone wanted. And this was hailed as a victory by the schools, by the conference. And in so doing, you know, they signed a 20-year contract that goes from 2016 to 2036.
And the other part of that, right, was the stability, was the idea that your league, for better or worse, wasn't going to fold. It was going to be bound to each other. And that's where you are now. Now, the TV contract they have suddenly is getting dwarfed and dwarfed and dwarfed and making people question. But I do think there is a sense, at least I get the feeling, that, hey, if they come out of this with whatever happens to these other conferences, whether it's the Big Ten and the SEC absorbing other leagues or just taking other schools and irreparably damaging the Pac-12 or the Big 12, if the ACC is still standing, I think you've got to look back on that grant of rights and say, okay, there was a victory in that.
Yes, and there's a couple different ways or a couple different components here, Mike. Think about all the changes we've had in the college sports media landscape just in the last 5 years. So try to play this out over the next 13 years. We have no idea what college sports and how it is consumed by fans is going to look like in 5, 10, 13 years. So maybe what the ACC has now won't be so, quote, debilitating, unquote, as it moves forward. And what we don't know, again, is whether ESPN and other television networks are finally going to say, no mas, and the bubble on these television rights pops. And we may, emphasis on may, be starting to see that, because as we speak, the SEC is holding its spring meetings down in Destin, Florida. And their big debate is, okay, now that we're adding Texas and Oklahoma, and we're going from 14 to 16 teams, are we now going to expand the conference schedule in football from 8 to 9 games? And one of the thoughts is among ADs, sure, let's do that because then ESPN will pay us more money. And ESPN is saying, maybe not. Maybe we've hit our limit. And if ESPN is hitting its limit with the SEC, then it might be hitting its limit with other conferences. And look at the trouble that the Pac-12 is having, getting its future media rights buttoned up. So trying to predict the future 5 years from now, let alone 13, is a fool's errand.
That's a really good point. And it brings me to my other question for you on this. I understand the idea if you're Clemson and Florida State and you've got great football brands, and as of last year, things are going well for both of those programs. But aren't you giving up? Because Florida State just came out of some lean years.
Oh, right?
Where I'm being nice when I say lean, where their success bonus wasn't going to be much of a bonus, right? They were going to be giving up money to other people. And I just wonder, with all of these moving parts and all of the shifting tectonic plates under college athletics, if you're presidents and ADs, don't you want the stability of knowing, hey, good year or bad year, here's what you're going to make? I just wonder if in this sort of cash grab moment, these programs might not live to regret this if they're not the ones on top.
Makes budget planning pretty difficult, right?
Right, exactly.
And what we don't know, Mike, and we're not going to know really until tax returns start popping in 3, 4, 5 years, because I don't believe for a minute that the ACC is going to put out a press release that says, here's exactly how we're going to distribute revenue. Here's the formula. That to me is a pipe dream. But TV revenue, my understanding is, will continue to be divided evenly. On its most recent tax return, TV revenue, Mike, was 71.9% of total income for the ACC. So we're not looking at a huge piece of the pie that is going to be divided unevenly.
Big enough that it moves the needle for these schools?
Or that's the great unknown. It's a great question.
It just feels to me like, I don't know, like a Band-Aid solution. Like, okay, you're doing well, you want some more money. Well, and the amount, when you're talking about the gap, as you've talked about with the Big Ten, with the SEC, you're not denting that, right? I mean the average right now is about, what, $18 million behind if you're the ACC compared to like the Big Ten. And it doesn't sound like we're talking about that level of change.
I don't think we are, but who knows what the expanded college football playoff is going to fetch on the open market. And that's the fact, Mike, that this is going to start in 2024-25. And that coinciding with the college football playoff expansion, that is very intentional, because that's when more money is going to come in. And that's when, in theory, there will be more money for this success initiative. And it will be fascinating to watch transpire over the years and see if some people do indeed come to regret it and find that planning is more difficult than ever. And then another thing that we don't know, what is the future relationship going to be between schools and athletes? Yeah, there are so many court cases out there. The NCAA and conferences, they're all on their hands and knees in D.C. begging for federal intervention on the NIL side. Are athletes going to become employees? So many moving parts. I do not envy any college athletic director right now. It strikes me as an impossible job.
Yeah, and that's, again, it's a reason why, to me, having some stability in what you're getting paid makes a lot of sense. And then I also question, if this money makes a difference, right? If you're Clemson football and you say, hey, getting this money is going to make us more competitive, can I extrapolate from that and say that if you're Boston College or Georgia Tech, that getting less money then your conference is going to make you less successful? And aren't we, in a sense, moving towards creating, and I know the point is to keep the league together, but aren't we creating the same split between the haves and have-nots that you're so worried about between the ACC and the SEC, now you're going to create it between the top of the ACC and the bottom of the ACC. Not that it's not already there, certainly to a large extent, but that just seems like a risk here to me.
I think it is. I think it's absolutely a risk. And, you know, will the success initiative play out long term that enough teams have gotten to that playoff level or earned enough in bonus money that they don't feel like they're lagging too far behind their ACC peers? Or is it going to create haves and have-nots within the league?
Yeah, I mean, if you have parity, then it would stand to reason your payouts would be kind of equitable. Mm-hmm. But we haven't seen a lot of parity on the football side. And we joke about coastal chaos and all that, and that's a different kind of parity. But in terms of going to the college football playoff or going to Final Fours, we have not seen parity in that regard, certainly not on the football side. So it's going to be interesting to watch. Now, David, is there going to be, I imagine, a difference in the success bonus payout, whatever we're calling it, for football versus, is it just men's basketball, women's basketball in there too? How are they doing?
It's just going to be men's basketball because that is the sport that drives the revenue from the NCAA. Now, since you ask about women's basketball, Charlie Baker, the new NCAA president, is on board with the idea, as is ACC Commissioner Jim Phillips, A-10 Commissioner Bernadette McGlade, I've talked to her about this, taking the media package of the NCAA women's basketball tournament away from the bundle that it's currently a part of with ESPN and taking that event to market separately. Because folks believe that is way undervalued. And I think anyone who observed the NCAA women's tournament this past season would agree. You know, Virginia Tech, LSU, Iowa, you know, Reese, Clark, you know, all the stars, the teams, and, you know, Liz Kitley at Virginia Tech. So if that gets taken to market and brings a big number, then maybe women's basketball would become part of the success initiative.
So the ACC presidents, the ACC ADs, they're kind of on board with this. I'll tell you who I think is going to face a lot of pressure from this. Not that they don't already, but it's the ACC coaches.
Coaches.
Right? Because now success used to be kind of a intangible thing, right? The impact of it. If you win, okay, the fans are more excited, the donors give more, but at what level? Do you have to win a national title? Do you have to win a league title? What bowl do you have to? And now you've got this very measurable metric, right? Are we getting a bigger share of the pie or a smaller share of the pie because of how well you did your job? Not that coaches aren't fired left and right willy-nilly anyway, but to me, this is going to ramp up the pressure on that group exponentially.
Mike, can you just see coaches' agents right now rubbing their hands together as they negotiate bonuses for their clients in a league with disparate revenue shares?
I mean, you say, hey, I bring in more money, you give me more money. Mm-hmm. But again, the flip side is always there. You bring in less money, we give you a pink slip. So it is going to be fascinating to see how it all unfolds. And such a complex topic, and always glad to have you walk me through it because you know this stuff a lot better than I do, the ins and outs of the finances here of the ACC. Somebody we both know real well, and we're going to bring him on here in a minute, but Devin Wilson, David, played point guard at Virginia Tech. He played under James Johnson. Then he played under Buzz Williams. Went out and GA'd actually under Mike Rhodes at VCU. I'm curious, David, what some of your, I don't know, recollections of Devin's time at Tech were, because when I thought back to Devin Wilson, I thought about a guy who just, he played so many minutes, right? He played so hard, so physical, and they just leaned on him those first 2 years minute-wise in kind of a way that was just crazy. It was such a workhorse. When you think about Devin, what stands out to you?
Defense. Yeah. Thought he was so good there. And then when he did the whole cup of coffee with the football team, man. You know, I remember talking to his high school football coach up in PA. And he said, you know, this is just not a lark for him. He was a good wideout in high school. And you mentioned the minutes and how tough he was. And that just dovetails right into the whole football player mentality.
Well, we're very happy to have Devin Wilson joining the show now. I enjoyed covering him during his Hokies career. He was at Tech from 2013 to 2018, played four seasons of basketball, a year of football in there, and he's back in Blacksburg now in a whole new role. We're going to talk about that and a whole lot more with him as he joins us now. Devin, how are you?
I'm doing great, Mike. How have you been?
Excellent. It's good to hear from you again. You were one of my personal favorites to cover when you were here, both for the way you played, which was, I thought, tenacious and just a guy who logged a ton of minutes. You never seemed to wear down. I'm guessing that's what Virginia Tech is going to want work-wise from you in your new role, unlimited minutes. But we're going to talk about what you did at Virginia Tech. And of course, we're going to get into a lot of why you're back, what you're going to be doing now. But first, let's catch our listeners up on what you've been doing post-college, because we kind of chronicled your time here pretty heavily when you were a Hokie. And then you went off and you were, I believe, at VCU, which will resonate with some of our listeners. You went out west. So just catch us up. What's been going on in your world?
Yeah, sure. So after finishing graduating, contemplated, you know, playing after like most basketball players and athletes in my position do. So I was able to go down to Vegas and I participated in a Eurobasket down there and was able to make the All-Star game. So I had a pretty good time in Vegas, got myself an agent. And then when I came back home, I just kind of realized that maybe basketball wasn't what I wanted to keep pursuing, but I wanted to stay within sports and still give back to what I loved the most. I just didn't necessarily think maybe that the actual basketball world of playing and working out every day and going through coaching and the business side of it was what I wanted to pursue, because I liked the college athletic style of life. So that's kind of where I was at. So then I tried to make a transition of, okay, what do I want to do? What's my next step? And then so what the first thing I thought of was, well, let's go back to Virginia Tech and go talk to the people who helped me in the first place. So I was able to go back to Virginia Tech. I talked to Buzz Williams and he was able to offer me and kind of give me some guidance into the VCU Center for Sport Leadership, which they have one of the best master's programs in the country for learning about, specifically, in my opinion, college athletics and how to be successful in it. So I was able to go to VCU and be a basketball GA for them with their men's basketball team under Mike Rhodes, who's now at Penn State, which was awesome. Most of the coaches on that staff recruited me, so it was a great warm welcome when I got there. And then only being 2-3 hours away from Virginia Tech, there was a bunch of just big community was strong there. And then so I finished my 2 years there and then decided that, you know, I didn't necessarily think that my education was rounded out as much as I wanted it to be. I thought I lacked in the business side of college athletics. So I wanted to kind of make sure I covered that. So the next thing I did was look up another great master's program that is out in San Diego State that actually has a sports MBA, which is one of the only MBAs that's applied to sports in the country. And so I was able to go out there, learn that in a year, graduated in December, and then got my actual first job, which is actually kind of funny to think about. Got my first like real job. And at San Diego State as a facilities and operations coordinator. And then I worked with the women's basketball team, the volleyball team, and the softball team, who's making a good run right now in the tournament by working with their facilities and operations and overall for their season. And then got the call for this, and now I'm here.
That's pretty awesome. I got a bunch to ask you about that, but I got to start by saying sometimes when people go to San Diego, we don't get them back on the East Coast. Was it hard to leave the weather and everything that San Diego has to offer?
It is. Yes. The weather's beautiful. The people are nice. The culture is unreal out there. There's so many different types of cultures. So diverse. It's so close to the border as well. So you got another culture right then and there. And then if you go up into the state, there's even more cultures that kind of populate the area. So being out in San Diego was really, really interesting. I got to learn a lot about West Coast sports and how they view college life. And there was just so many different experiences I was able to grab, but I don't think that I was a West Coast guy from the heart. I think I'm built for all four seasons. You know, I like seeing snow. I like being a little bit of cold. So coming back home has been awesome so far.
That's the McKees Rock Pittsburgh in you would make it hard, oh, yeah. I'm sure. So you mentioned good people, and I would imagine at VCU, because I know Mike Rhodes for a long time, back to his D3 coaching days. He's just a great guy. I imagine you got a lot out of that. I'm curious, did you cross paths with Greg Burton? Greg Burton used to be a local TV guy in the Richmond area, other places earlier in his career too, one of the really best guys in the business. I know he's involved at VCU. Did you happen to cross paths with my old friend Greg?
Oh, yes. Greg Burton's one of my guys. He's I use him for every reference I put on anything because I just know that he's going to speak highly of me because we had great interactions while I was at VCU. He's a big basketball guy covering Jordan and the Bulls in the 90s. Yeah. So we've had many talks about that. So yeah, Greg Burton is one of my best, I could say honestly, now that I've graduated, one of my best friends. I still try to keep in contact with him. And then also he's been one of my best mentors. So any one time I have a question to ask him about college athletics or kind of where my head is at, what I should think about doing, he's always been there to give me great advice and never has shied away from being that type of person he is, which is emphatic energy and just a great person overall.
Absolutely. Well, you got some great people in your corner. I'm curious though. So you go and you GA with Coach Rhodes. You played for Buzz. You played for James Johnson. Was coaching ever the direction you were headed? Is that still something that you may want to return to, or is that just kind of a different life?
I think the way you ended that question is the perfect way to put it. It's just a different lifestyle. And I think most people who are built for the coaching lifestyle and that love it, they have a different type of tenacity to them. They're in the office for 12 hours, just recruiting all day and doing a bunch of different things that a lot of people don't know they do behind the scenes. So when I got to VCU, I was already administration heavy. I knew that's what I wanted to do because I was able to speak with Whit Babcock when I was a senior in college about kind of what his role is and what he does on a daily basis. And I love just hearing about it and what he does. So I already had my mindset kind of set on administration. So Mike Rhodes was actually great in this. He was able to kind of put me under the director of basketball operations and Jimmy Martelli, who his dad actually recruited me coming out of college. So I had a great relationship with him. So we had a great working relationship. And then, so I was already in administration at that point. All the coaches there, they tried to get me to lean into coaching because I do, I think, have a knack for it. I think I create relationships well with players. I think I'm very, very detailed in player workouts and individual workouts. Like when I was at VCU, all the guys would always tell me that I was the guy they wanted to work out with just because I think I put a lot into it when I am actually doing it. And it's actually something I love to kind of see people get better. But then there's that other side of coaching where there's the recruiting, there's the traveling, there's the lack of seeing your family and the lack of kind of job safety all the time. So with those factors leaked into it, I kind of decided that coaching might not be the best thing for a calm, cool guy like myself.
See, when you go and get all those degrees, that's when you start to understand that a little bit better. So I think you've got a good grasp on the situation. Now, tell me, how do you then transition? Because I think if I'm remembering this right, and if I'm wrong, stop me and we can edit it out. But I thought I remembered at the end of your tech time, you telling me that you were writing a letter to Whit Babcock, or you were having a call with him. Take me back if I'm not crazy. Did you have some kind of contact there, kind of talking about his experience and what you've seen?
Yeah. See, this is why you're one of the best, Mike. See, that's a great memory because I actually just talked about this a little bit ago. But yes, I wrote a handwritten letter to Whit Babcock my senior year, just kind of outlining all the things that I thanked him for. Because when he first came in, as you know, we were struggling as a basketball program, and he was able to make some changes with the coaching staff and kind of the program in general, giving it more backing, more money behind it to kind of get us to where we ended up being now and being a established program in the ACC. So I was just pretty much saying thank you for your time being here, because it mirrored my time as well. And he ended up reaching back out to me probably like a day later. It was at like our shoot around, and he walked up to me and said like, hey, I wanted to thank you actually, because that was the first time that anyone in that student athlete role has ever sent me like a letter thanking me for what I've done or like anything like that. So he was extremely appreciative of it. And just seeing how appreciative of that handwritten letter he was, it just kind of reassured in me that like, yeah, this is the type of business I want to get into with this type of people, because they're doing it for the right reasons. And the right reasons is anything that gets these student athletes to be better, both on the court and off the court, is what we're all here for.
And little did you know, but now he's your boss. So to take us through that, take us through your new position with the Monogram Club, what you're going to be doing, and how you got back to Blacksburg. Did they reach out to you? You're obviously a natural fit, having been a basketball and a football guy, everything you poured in. How did this come to be?
So I can walk you through the timeline a little bit. So I graduated in December with my MBA. So right then and there, I was kind of already looking for like a job now that I had my degree, because I had already started with San Diego State at that time. So I was about 2 months into my position. So then once I graduated, I started to look around like for things that maybe I truly wanted to do, which was more in the advancement and relationship kind of avenue. So I was able to, was actually kind of interesting. So on they posted the job January 10th. I emailed Witt on January 9th just as a check-in, like, hey, how's everything been? I just want to let you know I graduated. I'm looking for different positions around the country. Like, just wanted to just kind of check in. Nothing, not asking for a job or anything. Just wanted to kind of be around still. And literally the next day they posted this position. So I don't know. I don't know if it was a little coincidence. I don't know if it was on purpose. Who knows? But we'll leave that to the conspiracy theorists. But the next day it was posted. And then from that point on, I applied. I was able to get my first interview with Raina and the rest of the search committee. And then I was able to do an interview with HR about a week later. And then it was actually kind of, it worked out well because I was already had tickets to the UVA game. So, and that was kind of in the middle of my interview process. So I was able to come back and speak to John Boleyn and just understand what they were looking for from the Monogram Club and just kind of do more due diligence and kind of show my face around. And then about 2 weeks later, I got my second interview to come back in person. So I was back in Blacksburg and then finally got the offer for the position around early May, late April.
Now, as I said, you seem like a natural fit for it because you did play not just one, but two sports at Tech. You spent a lot of time, got your degree. The fact that you have the education background you have, obviously this has been your goal and what you're pursuing. Was the interview process, to go into basketball terms, kind of a slam dunk? I mean, did it feel like as you're talking, hey, this job is made for me?
Yes, I felt extremely confident throughout the entire interview process. I just felt that there was no one else better from a not only educational standpoint, but also from a personal standpoint of me having experience being here and being a student athlete and then not being one of the student athletes who went to go play pro, but someone who decided to do something completely different and was still able to be successful and still able to contribute and kind of give back to the university he went to, where most people kind of can't be in that situation. So I thought that was pretty cool. Go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah. So let's break down what you're going to be doing in this new role now, because I think former athletes maybe have an idea what the Monogram Club is. Maybe yes, maybe no. But the average fan maybe does not at all. So take us through, what is this position? What's the work you're going to be doing?
Sure. Yes. So the Monogram Club is our student athlete alumni club. It involves former student athletes, trainers, managers, and videos staff that have been through Virginia Tech and worked with the sport. So all those people can contribute and be a part of it. It is a dues paying club. So we're not necessarily trying to find donations, but we're using it for that donation goes towards the betterment of the club. And then also half the donation goes towards for those endowment scholarships. So that scholarship goes directly towards our current student athletes. So it's a great way for our alumni to be able to directly support the current student athletes today. And then in this role, I'll be essentially planning events, planning communication and engagement with alumni and student athlete alumni. Some of the events that we have are like the Hall of Fame ceremony that we'll be having in September. We have the For Those to Come golf outing that happens usually in April during the spring game we just had. And then along with other plethora of events that coincide with the department that I'm under, which is the Student Athlete Development Group. So they do things like Career Jumpstart. And then I know that Sarah Lage, which is one of our senior people over at Student Athlete Development, she has created a program called Beyond VT, which is a great leapfrog to taking the seniors who are graduating and figuring out what they want to do after and leading them into the Monogram Club. So we have a great avenue and pipeline of being able to move our current student athletes and working them and educating them on what the Monogram Club is and why they should want to be a part of it through our natural programs. And then once they kind of graduate, they're able to kind of experience what the Monogram Club can be in full effect once they leave campus.
Now you are, as we've mentioned, a former athlete. How have you found the outreach? Is it an area that is lacking? And is there change needed? Is it just, kind of expanding, or how do you view it? Because we've heard from people who are former players who felt that maybe there wasn't enough connection between the alumni and there wasn't enough going on, enough events, enough, I don't know, giveaways and gifts that maybe, not that they were forgotten, but that wasn't strong enough. Obviously, this position seems like a way to address that. How would you evaluate kind of the way things are right now?
Yes, I'll be honest with you, Mike. I think we've lacked in engaging our former student athletes. And I think that's something that has been happening all across the country. I don't know if you've noticed at all, but there's been a bunch of different programs such as the Monogram Club arising and being put more towards the spotlight at different colleges. For example, at Notre Dame, it's really, really big. At Ohio State, it's really, really big and important. So schools are starting to realize that there's enough student athlete alumni who have now played and want to give back because of the university, because of what the university gave to them. And so schools are really trying to put a focus on that. So I think that's what we need to do here at Virginia Tech, because we've kind of not had a focus on it, but I think putting a focus on it will bring together a family, because like we all say, this is home. So being able to bring back as many athletes as you can, bring back as many alumni or managers, anyone involved in those programs, only can encourage and kind of build on the growth that's already been set over the last 5 years that we've been having. And I think putting more time and focus into this program can just completely enhance that.
Do you focus, because I think there's an opportunity with, you know, young alumni, right, to get them into things, and it just becomes their lifestyle. You leave school, you stay connected. Is there a challenge to reconnecting with the older alums, some of those people who maybe do feel like they've lost connections, and will you be involved on that end at all?
That's an interesting question, Mike, because our biggest member group is probably our older generation, because of they understand the alumni process. So not only are they, most of them, part of the Monogram Club, but they're also part of the Hokie Club. So they understand what donating is, how it applies to them, how much money they can give, and then also what that donation does for the current student athletes. So I think our biggest disconnect right now is bringing back the younger student athletes, like my class and younger, and then even up to like Malcolm Delaney in their class, that maybe has kind of been not forgotten about, but kind of put to the side, because we've had so many coaching changes in the last probably 10 to 15 years with Seth Greenberg and Buzz, and then now Mike Young. So I think sometimes when you don't have a central unit to come back to, it kind of makes it a little more difficult for younger people. So that's one of the first groups that I think we're going to reach out to and try to engage with, is getting them to become members early on. Because once you do graduate with the Monogram Club, your first 3 years, if you would like to, are complimentary. So we're already introducing to these athletes that once you graduate, you're already a part of the club. And now it's just about re-engaging them over the years after their 3 years are done, to let them know, now that you're in a position to help, how would you like to be? Whether it's your time, whether it's your advice, whether it's coming back on campus and just hanging out with the guys or the girls, anything that kind of gives our student athletes to know that the people who have came through here before love this place just as much as they do currently.
Well, that's smart. Makes a lot of sense. That you mentioned all that coaching change. And I mean, I think of all the guys I've covered just in my time doing this. Have you gotten to know Brent Pry? Have you gotten to know Mike Young? And what can they bring, or what can they add to your position?
Yeah, I haven't gotten to personally meet Coach Pry yet, but it was actually kind of funny. I was walking up the hill yesterday, and he was driving out of the parking lot, and he like bumped the beeper like twice and was like, "Devin, like, congratulations." I was like, "Oh, thanks, Coach Pry. I appreciate it." Like, I was like, "That's awesome." They're like, that's what you want to see out of your head coach, like giving congratulations to someone who just got here. So I think with that energy already, I think he'll be a huge help. He's already been really, really vocal in the recruiting process and on Twitter, and just engaging people on Twitter. So I think he'll be an easy way to slide in, especially with football here is our biggest group with the Monogram Club. They're usually our most represented group. So I think just adding him will just add on to the people who've already established themselves, like the Edmonds brothers, with the Monogram Club. And then for Coach Young, I've definitely got to meet Coach Young a bunch more times. I hang out at the basketball facility pretty much every day anyways. So I got to meet Coach Young a bunch of times, and he's a great guy. And I think he wants to build a program that has guys coming back like he did at Watford, because we've already had Kiva Luma's actually back right now. So I think he's trying to build that camaraderie and that program of, hey, I want to be here for some time, and that we can really build on this from the ground up. So I think they're both extremely excited to kind of get started. And then on top of that, they've already been implementing practices that we would use in the Monogram Club with their own alumni club already, or alumni already.
Good stuff. Let me ask you one that may be not on your desk or above your pay grade, or just not something you've really thought about yet. But as we talk, it's kind of on my mind. We've seen such a disruption of college programs because of the transfer portal, right? You know, guys sit out a year, don't get great playing time, they move on. Is there an element in your job in terms of building that community that might help combat that down the line? In other words, hey, maybe you didn't play a ton of minutes or get a ton of snaps, but you're part of this community. Do you think that the work you're doing might help programs develop a little more stability?
Yes, I definitely believe that. I think one to start that will help that is my own personal experience of being here. I think I can relay what I went through, which was one of the most unique stories you could probably imagine in college basketball / football, college sports in general. So I think my own voice will be a huge help in that. And then two, in helping these kids kind of stick around is building something that they know they can come back to. I think that's huge for a lot of kids. They want a home. They want somewhere when they graduate, whether they go pro or not, that they can come back and feel the love that they felt when they were here. And that's something I would like to kind of harp on is, since I've been back, there's been nothing but congratulations and love from almost every single person that either recognizes me or that I've known from previous years of being here. So the love that I've received has been amazing. And I didn't go pro. I didn't average 20 points a game. I wasn't an All-American. So it just goes to show that the legacy you leave here of who you are as a person it outweighs the stats. It outweighs the performances on the field, because they don't always remember those. You're going to have bad games. You're going to have great games, but who you are off the field or off the court is so much more important at Virginia Tech than I think anywhere else in the country. And we need to stress that the legacy of these athletes is who they are and their character more than it is what they have done on the field.
Very well said. Now, you didn't turn pro, but you were a fan favorite here. You had a great athletic career at Virginia Tech. So I got to ask you before I let you go, when you think back on everything you did here athletically, is there a moment on the court, on the field, maybe one or two that stands out as your favorite?
Whew, that's a good question, Mike. I would say yes. For basketball, the night we beat Duke on my senior night was probably one of the best experiences. Just seeing the crowd, the game level, the way the game ended, like everything just kind of was just like a cherry on the cake. You know what I mean? It was a beautiful way to end my run in Castle. It was like, man, like everything's kind of come full circle. And then you fast forward, what, 2-3 weeks, and then I'm playing my last game in my home city. So the way I think I ended my basketball career was absolutely beautiful. I thought I couldn't have finished it anyway better unless we would have beat Alabama. But I mean, hey, it was a great game, so you can't always win everything, right? But that was awesome. And then from a football standpoint, I think the coolest thing, and I tell a lot of people this, is I didn't get to play this game, but we played in the Belk Bowl, and I got to see us come back from halftime. I think we were down like 21, 24 points or something like that, and got to see like every guy that like who was a stud on our team was just making plays. Tremaine Edmonds, Terrell, like everyone was just making plays, and it was just a beautiful kind of to see that football symbiotic relationship happen on the field with all those different guys. And then literally the next day, I was suited up for the game against Duke we had at home. So I went from literally one sport, drove 3 hours all the way back to Blacksburg with my parents, and was in layup lines and passing and ready to go. Like if they wanted me to play, which obviously I wouldn't have played because I probably couldn't have made it up and down the court two times. But that was probably my two biggest memories of just being able to transfer, and how everyone's kind of, it was such an easy transition from going to football to basketball. No one had a problem with it. None of my coaches had issues with it. It was just, I couldn't complain about any time I've had here.
Well, that is awesome, and I consider myself very fortunate that I got to cover all of those games and moments you just mentioned, and it's great to have you back, to know you're going to be around, and look forward to talking to you in the future. Congratulations, and thanks for joining us here today.
Thank you, Mike. I appreciate it, and I want to give you a thank you, too. I always appreciated the care you showed for after games and interviews. You never were that type of person who was trying to dig in there or try to get an answer they weren't trying to get with their questions, so I always appreciated you being as a reporter as well.
Well, thanks, man. I hope that continues here in your new role.
Thank you, man. Have a good one.
Well, thanks for listening. You can subscribe to Teal and Barber on Apple Podcasts or wherever you find your favorite pods. And please consider supporting local journalism with an online subscription to the Times-Dispatch. You can find special promotional offers available at richmond.com. Today's show was produced by Dean Hoffmeyer and yours truly. Teal and Barber is a podcast of the Richmond Times-Dispatch and richmond.com. For David Teal, I'm Mike Barber. Thanks for listening. Be healthy and safe, and please join David and me again next time.